and hatred to mankind, poisoning their brainwashed minds.
This is Bob Fitrakis bringing you the other side of the news on WGRN 94.1. I'm speaking with Roger Hill, an old ally in the struggle for justice. And again, in this past year, he's been focusing as a filmmaker on a video that I'm somewhat familiar with from some of my own reporting over the years, like cops, cover-up, and corruption. But a long time ago, even prior to that, you remember, of course, since you made it, your video known as Struggle, which I thought had some of the most incredible footage of the inauguration of George W. Bush. You remember that? And of course, you made it. And what do you think about it now?
That was the film that nearly broke me as a filmmaker, but it definitely.
What do you mean by that? Tell our listeners.
You know what, Bob? You would probably be the one to understand this, just the feeling of being overwhelmed with the amount of evidence that came out indicating election fraud and vast voter suppression in that 2004 presidential election. So, for me to distill that into something watchable in under an hour was incredibly challenging. But I am happy to report that the film has actually found a bit of a new life.
Thanks to Donald Trump and Roger Stone, who interviewed me twice.
Right.
And said I was right.
An outlet called, I don't know if you're familiar with Means TV. They picked it up last year. It's kind of like a socialist, anti-capitalist Netflix, cool. Means.tv. So they've got a couple of my documentaries on there, including Struggle. The inauguration was very intense. I think we...
Well, you didn't see that on mainstream corporate media.
No, you didn't see any of that.
Well, it actually happened. That's why you didn't get to see it.
Right, exactly. If it was a fantasy, it would have got plenty of play. But because it was real, they decided it was not palatable to the audience, I guess. But yes, that's how we got our start working together. And it's nice to see you again.
Well, how are you doing? You were in San Francisco. Now you're back in Cleveland.
Doing good, all things considered. It's been nice to be back in Ohio, back in the fight, so to speak. San Francisco is a bit of a bubble, so it's
not a red city.
No, not at all. So I feel good to have my boots back on the ground here, and been doing some documentary stuff, getting back into documentary stuff. So it's been good.
They won't be truly back on the ground till you get some good police abuse.
Yeah, right. Which is a good segue to my current project.
That's right. Your new documentary, and which is part of the series. Tell us about it.
Yeah. So the documentary series is called State of Injustice. You can check it out at stateofinjustice.com. Friend and colleague Brian Douglas was approached by Black Lives Matter Cleveland to do a video telling the story of the death of Luke Stewart. Luke Stewart is a young Black man in Euclid, Ohio, who was sleeping in his car, was awoken by two cops jumping into his car, literally one of them jumping into his car. We don't know what happened because the cops didn't have their dash cams on, though they were supposed to. Neither of them were wearing body cams. So all we have is the telling of the cops' side of the story. However, we were able to get the audio of them relaying that story to the Bureau of Criminal Investigations. And, even though they had time to prepare their statements, it's still pretty damning and self-incriminating. On top of that, we provide interviews with the attorney of Luke's family and archival footage from different sources, such as the Euclid City Hall. Euclid Public Library does a great job of recording the City Hall meetings, and we found all kinds of incredible footage in there too. So
a lot of this was public records that nobody was using.
Yeah, exactly. We are the first people to publish the BCI audio and the first people to dig through the City Hall footage as well, the City Council footage. So the first episode is the story of Luke Stewart. And in investigating this, we found a dark well of corruption and abuse plaguing the Euclid Police Department, enough so that we have content for three additional episodes, which will be staggered over the next few months.
Well, that's nice when you got a series. Well, you know, Ohio Police, it may end up being a couple decades long.
Yeah, sadly, there is no shortage of corruption to report on.
So, what was the outcome in the Luke Stewart case?
The two officers were both cleared of any wrongdoing. The officer who shot Luke five times was put back on duty within 5 or 6 days, I think, remains on the force, patrolling Euclid. There's a civil suit pending. I don't know the outcome to that yet. And actually, this will be covered in episode 4, but citizens filed criminal charges against Officer Matthew Rhodes. So again, that actually did not get bounced. That is going to move forward. It was assigned a prosecutor, and that's where it stands right now. So a lot of it is still very fluid.
Well, I noticed you have an Indiegogo page for your film. You need to raise a little money and want to make a pitch?
Yeah. So if you go to stateofinjustice.com, it'll take you right to the Indiegogo page. You can watch the first episode right there on the page. Black Lives Matter Cleveland is the executive producer of the project. You can get more information about the subsequent episodes there too. So stateofinjustice.com, it'll take you right there. You can watch the first episode. We did the first episode as a proof of concept, and now we need to raise money to finish the subsequent three episodes.
And when did this happen, with Luke, with the police murdering him?
March of 2017. And it's actually been getting a little bit of attention recently nationally. There was an article in, Suzanne just called me 30 minutes ago to set this interview up. I forget. I think it was the New Yorker. If it wasn't the New Yorker, it was.
It's like some of your early projects that were quite good.
Right.
Spontaneous.
We'll just say it has been getting new attention. So that has been good. But we also investigate other high profile police excessive force, use of excessive force on other Euclid residents between 2016 through 2020. And so there's a lot more to it. Luke's case is a big case, but there's more to it than Luke's case.
And probably far more people are familiar with Tamir Rice, another case there where the police were not held accountable. So this should be interesting to bring out Luke's case a little more to the public. And will that be part of the series?
We have had discussions with Tamir's mother, Samaria Rice, and possibly. We started with the case of Luke Stewart because that was what we were approached by BLM Cleveland. I think the next season, though, we're going to go to East Cleveland. because East Cleveland is fraught with violence and corruption. And then I think we'll just keep migrating to Cleveland, including Tamir Rice and a variety, several other less you know, known incidents of police killing Black people.
And were there other events in Euclid? Was there a history there of racism?
Yeah, definitely. So Euclid was it's a suburb of Cleveland, about 50 or 60,000 people. Originally, it was a majority white suburb, but over the last 20 years or so, there's been a steady migration of African Americans into the city, and it's now about 50-50. However,
and what's the police department? 50-50?
No, the police department is about 95% white. I know
God fearing occupying army.
Yes, very much so. And it's not even just that, but it's a lot of the police on the force were fired from other police departments. It seems
only the best. They had to have the resume. You've been fired for abusing a citizen.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Exactly. Michael Amiot, for example, who has been involved in several high profile use of force beatings of, innocent people. He was deemed too crazy to work in Mentor. So Mentor.
And if you're too crazy for Mentor, exactly. There's only a few places left on earth.
Yep. So Euclid is the sort of refuge for shitty cops. Oh, I don't know if I can swear on this, for bad cops. Of the two or three Black police officers, one of them was eventually fired for domestic violence. However, he and Michael Amiot each have gotten both have gotten their jobs back through binding arbitration in the police contracts. So
binding injustice to the police union.
Exactly. So it takes a pretty extreme amount of reckless violence to get fired from the Euclid Police Department. There actually have been three. Two of the three got their jobs back. The third pulled his gun at a bar, got into a fight with Hell's Angels, had a DUI, was arrested for shooting his gun into Lake Erie. He was fired and then came back in 2020 and shot and killed himself in the lobby of the Euclid Police Department. So there's just so much toxic energy surrounding that department and its police chief mayor that four episodes is kind of the minimum needed to crack into it all.
And are you going to go into, we only got a couple minutes left. You're going to go into any sort of reform ideas?
Yeah, there will be, in season four parsed throughout, a lot of it is just to sort of open people's eyes and to, inform them what's happened and what is happening in Euclid, and to teach people about things like qualified immunity and binding arbitration and what that means when it comes to the attempt to remove toxic police. But yes, I think probably in the fourth episode, there will be a little more concentrated effort to present solutions.
Well, Roger, in this last minute, I'm thanking you for appearing on the other side of the news, WGRN 94.1 FM, the Green Renaissance, streaming live on WGRN.org. So they'll know your face there. So thanks a lot. I appreciate you coming up to the show. Oh, and the Indiegogo.
Yep, just go to stateofinjustice.com and that'll take you to the Indiegogo page.
All right, and he's got enough materials to go at least four decades.
Yeah, probably.
To Ohio, maybe longer.
Yeah, I know, right? Okay, thank you, Bob. Appreciate your time.
You're welcome. Thank you. Hi, I'm Bob Fitrakis. A bit hoarse today, but that's just the excitement that Miriam Vargas We look in the newspaper here. Miriam Vargas has been freed, and we have the pastor that provided sanctuary, Sally Padgett, with us today. Welcome to the other side of the news, and how you feeling?
Thank you for having me, and I feel great. In the last year, there hasn't been a whole lot of really good news, so this is just great news.
And how did you hear about the great news?
Actually, last Thursday when Edith Espinal got home, or we heard Edith Espinal had gone to ICE and gotten home, we instantly had Miriam's lawyer call ICE, and ICE said they were going to have the same deal for her. And so we set the appointment, and we were waiting right outside the ICE building when Miriam came out. So we have been with her every step of the way. I actually got to drive her up there, and we've been with her this whole time.
Well, good for you. And again, many of us have supported your operation, which has been outstanding. It goes beyond Miriam to the questions of social justice for those that may be a little different and may have got here in some cases earlier or later in our country. What circumstances caused you to offer sanctuary to Miriam?
To hear Miriam's story, to me, I just connected with it. And, you know, as a pastor, I'm always thinking, you know, we're always taught to do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And so for me, hearing Miriam's story, she was a mother. You know, they wanted to separate her from her children. I mean, ICE basically told her, you can either take your children who are U.S. citizens back to Honduras with you, and, you know, and all the danger that that entails, or you can leave them here in the country and put them up for adoption. And to me, as a mother myself, and hearing that story, I was like, that's not a choice. And so we offered sanctuary very easily and quickly for her. Because again, to hear that story, I don't think anybody should ever have to contemplate those two choices. And so we gave her a third option. And now she's going to be able to stay with her kids and raise her kids and have the life that she's always wanted for her and her family.
So what was it like supporting the project so long, offering sanctuary so long? And of course, how was it for Miriam from what you observed?
Yeah, the church didn't do it alone. We had lots of supporters, as you said, lots of people, including many of your listeners were part of this process. And for us, I mean, for me, it's kind of that catch-22 where it was a pleasure to meet Miriam. It was, always great to walk in the church and see her face. But on the other side, on Miriam's side, it was extremely hard. It created a lot of stress, especially this year with COVID. She herself went through COVID. She had to, do that here in the church, always thinking about what if I have to go to the hospital, so there was a lot of moments of stress, just missing her kids. Like one of the things she said she can't wait to do is go to her daughter's violin concerts, like she missed all those little moments and that created a lot of stress for her and just a lot of sadness for her. So while, the church had a really great experience having her here, we also realized how hard it was for her. And we tried to do our best to make the experience as painless as possible. So we tried to take care of her, all her needs, but you can only do so much. So yeah, it was a great experience for the church. I would never want to do it again, just because I don't want people to be in the same situation Miriam was in. But it was a good experience. But for Miriam, extremely hard. And she, even going to the ICE building, you could tell she couldn't even believe that this was maybe even a possibility almost after 3 years here in this church.
And what challenges did the church itself face by offering sanctuary?
I think just making sure that Miriam was supported and as comfortable as possible. We really, people were great. I have to say, we really did not have anybody, come out and threaten us, or, people were extremely supportive of what we were doing. And so, you know, that part of it was really great. But just the hardest part was probably watching Miriam go through what she had to go through and knowing that there was nothing we could do. You know, that was heartbreaking almost.
And what did the community do to support you? You talked about them not doing anything bad. What about the positive stuff they did?
Oh, people welcomed her with open arms. People in the community would drop off produce, you know, because her daughter loves, you know, produce, eats fruit all the time. So they would drop off fresh produce. They would just come and, you know, wave outside at, you know, at the building if she was, you know, if so they could see her. They, you know, constantly were financially supportive. You know, anytime there was a need, they were right there, and people, you know, were just really, really great.
Now, what changed so quickly? 1 minute she's in sanctuary.
Yeah, it was really the Biden administration. You know, we just a couple of weeks ago, I don't know if people saw in the newspaper, we had taken stays of deportation to ICE and they were rejected by ICE. Edith and Miriam both did. And within 2 weeks later, you know, they were calling us to say, hey, you know, you guys can come and, you know, we'll give you this deal. She still has a stay of deportation. So that has not been removed, but now she's under an order of supervision. So instead of having to be in the church, she can now, you know, be at home with her family and have her own apartment. And they're even going to let her work. So, you know, that's great. She can support her family. And, you know, so it was really, ICE said that under the Biden administration, Miriam and Edith are no longer the targets of the ICE. Who the targets are people who have committed a felony, which neither Miriam or Edith have. And so they are just not the priority of ICE right now, according to the Biden administration. And so therefore, they're going to allow them to check in. They still have to check in every 4 months. You know, they have to abide by certain rules. She can't leave the state. You know, there's a lot of different rules, but she can be at home living with her family.
But it was ICE who contacted the sanctuary and Miriam.
Yeah. Right. Well, I guess I should say for Edith, ICE contacted them. And then we immediately hearing that, and they were the ones, they told Joel Miller, the pastor of the Mennonite church where Edith was. And then, you know, we told our lawyer and our lawyer contacted them, but they were more than willing and ready to reach out and have the same deal for Miriam. Yeah.
And one of the things that I'll remember, there's a phone around here with a little Miriam sticker on it. Mm-hmm. And there's yard signs all over Central Ohio. Whose idea was that?
That was always our team's idea. I actually think it was maybe Tim Chavez, who works at the station. I think it might have been his idea, but we wanted to get Miriam's word out there. And just to say, the fight needs to continue for a path to citizenship. Although she gets to go home, if there is a administration change, she could be right back in the same situation she is. So we want to continue to fight and to push our legislatures to continue the fight for a path for citizenship for people who are in this country undocumented. You know, right now she's able to go home, but that doesn't mean it will stay that way. And until she actually is on the path to citizenship, she still is at risk if there's an administration change.
How do you think her life will be different now?
I think just being able to, I think we all take for granted the fact that we can go walk our dog around the block. I think we take for granted the fact that we can go to our children's, you know, concerts. We can go to PTA meetings. We can drop our kids off from school or pick them up when they're sick. We can go to doctor's appointments. You know, I mean, how do you go to a dentist when you're living in the church? You know, there's a lot of things we just take for granted. Like just yesterday, she walked around the front of the church and she goes, I don't think I've ever walked around the front of the church, because she came in and she didn't feel comfortable going out to Main Street, you know, where ICE might drive by and see her. So, I mean, you know, she was really a prisoner in some ways in this church. And so just feeling that freedom of saying, I can go to the grocery store and I can buy the groceries I want to buy. I can, you know, she can do what she wants to do now. It's just the little things I think she really missed. You know, she did say she hopes to one day take her daughter to Disney World because her daughter's at that age where she loves the Disney princesses. But, you know, just being able to do the normal everyday things, you don't realize how much you would miss them if you can't do them.
Now, what will the church be like without her?
Oh, we are definitely going to miss her, and we hope to stay in touch, you know, and have her come back for worship and stuff. But, you know, we are a church that believes in advocacy and social justice. So, you know, once Miriam's settled, we hope to find another project or, you know, or something we can dig our teeth into. You know, there's all kinds, you know, sadly, there's a lot of need in this world. And so we just to continue to want to be a presence to meet the needs that are out there for people who are living on the margins or don't feel like their voice is heard.
And again, you were clarifying it. What will your work be with immigration?
Yeah, we will continue to have a team. You know, Miriam has a team that supports her, and we were meeting weekly. And we want to continue to advocate for a path to citizenship for, you know, people who are undocumented. We want to continue to work to make sure that they have a fair treatment, and that if the administration changes again, that they're not just left to, you know, have to leave their lives as they were. So we're going to continue to advocate and reach out to, you know, the people who hold power and make sure that this happens. There are so many people that are just always living in fear. And so how do we alleviate that and make sure that they can, and these are good people. You know, like I said, Miriam is one of the best people I know. So it's just people trying to live their lives. And so many people can put up roadblocks to that and totally change her life. And we need to have her have some stability in her life.
Well, I'm talking with Reverend Sally Padgett here on the East Side. And I always remember was it the First English?
Yeah, it's First English Lutheran Church. Everybody wonders what the English was. We were actually in 1848, the first church that spoke English instead of German during worship. And that actually caused quite a ruckus back then. So it's amazing to think that that was like a big issue, but it was. So we were the first non-German speaking church, Lutheran church in Columbus.
Was ist los? We're talking about Miriam Vargas. Being able to leave sanctuary, and of course, from Honduras.
Yes, yes.
So she didn't speak German.
No, she didn't. She spoke Spanish.
All right. In this last minute, how can people help get involved, volunteer?
Yeah, reach out to your, you know, your congresspeople, your senators, your city council members, your state representatives, and just let them know that this is an important issue to you, that you want to make sure that all people who are here undocumented get a fair path to citizenship. You know, right now, if you are in this country undocumented, there is no way, except if you leave the country and try to come back in, that there is no way you can become a citizen. And you know, these are a lot of people who are hardworking, you know, people who value their family, and they just want a chance at a better life.
Well, thank you, Reverend Sally Padgett, for coming on the other side of the news.
I appreciate you having me and supporting
Miriam. And for Miriam, you and Miriam making the other side of the news as well.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for listening to The Other Side of the News. This is Bob Fitrakis.
And Dan Dugan, WGRN 94.1 LPFM, The Green Renaissance.